All right, everyone, since it's 4 o'clock, we're going to go ahead and get started while we tweak the resolution on the screen. And just one housekeeping thing, if you're interested in the AIA credits for this, the sign-up sheet is out in the hallway, right outside the door. And I'd like to thank all of you for sticking with us. It's always fun to be the very last time slot on the panel because you don't know if people are actually going to show up or not. So our first speaker has come a long way. Stephen Marshall is a senior lecturer at the Bartlett School of Planning from the University College in London. So I'm glad we have a turnout, that people have stuck around. And he's got a real diverse experience from street planning and design, international research, and authoring several publications, all relating to how transport and planning and urban design issues come together. So with that, I think we're ready.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for that introduction and for inviting me along. It's very nice to be here. This session is about pedestrian-oriented streets. What I'll be seeing is a bit of an overview. So I'll be going over some points that probably most of you will be familiar with in one way or another, I'm sure. But hopefully putting them together in a way that maybe can help stimulate thought and discussion before the more specific, perhaps more specific technical presentations that follow. Okay. So just a kind of question to kick off with, what is a naturally good pedestrian environment? And one particular example springs to mind of the kind of thing that we're probably familiar with. I guess, do people know where this is, in this particular map? I use this as an example partly because it shows the intricate fabric, urban fabric, which one of the distinguishing features of this map is that it shows the interiors of the buildings as well that are publicly accessible. Which you might be able to see in some of the details. I also discovered this rather fine tie on sale in the lobby down below, which shows the same pattern from the same map, so I felt I just had to buy it. And there's still a few copies. I thought I'd better buy it before I make this talk, since in case I miss it, if everyone goes and ends up buying this tie. Anyway, there are also versions for Paris, London, and New York, Philadelphia, and some other cities. Chicago. Okay, thank you. Boston. Okay, thank you. Any more? San Francisco. Okay, thanks. My attention was on Rome, you can imagine. I know what London looks like. So this kind of map, I suggest, is the kind of, perhaps the kind of environment that we're familiar with as a kind of typical pedestrian-friendly environment. However, when I was trying to research into this, I came across an example that I thought was perhaps even more extremely pedestrian-oriented, this being the Neolithic settlement of Çatalhöyük in Anatolia, in part of Turkey, where the circulation was all on the roof of the buildings, so people to enter the buildings went down the trapdoors inside the buildings. So this settlement form, it was pedestrian-oriented in the sense that, the pedestrian is really the mode of transport for this form. It's hard to imagine vehicular transport or horses or other kinds of traction, non-human traction, being suitable for this kind of environment. And, of course, once you start doing these things, you end up going back as far as you can to see, well, what ultimately would be the first pedestrian environment. And for the walking mode, I suppose. And indeed, Steven Pinker, in his book How the Mind Works, explains some of the ideas behind how humanity evolved in the savanna landscape, where there are distinctive features about it regarding the ability to see at certain distances, and there's a combination of prospect and refuge. There's a certain amount of complexity there. It's not as it's simple as a completely flat plain. It's not the densest rainforest kind of environment, but there's a mixture of these things, and savanna, which can also equate with perhaps know, modern suburbia or something, places where people like to be, where you can see and be seen, there are escape routes you can go, and so on. So perhaps this could represent one kind of pedestrian environment. We're more familiar perhaps with designing urban things, and I'm sure several of our colleagues who went on a trip to Stockholm a few years ago might recognise this slide from the old town of Stockholm, where there's a little bit of nature coming into the scene there as well. A very nice, attractive, walkable environment for the pedestrian. What else? I thought I may as well have some people in the picture at some point. This is in Shanghai. This is just meant to show the busyness and the kind of commercial aspect of streets where people are going around window shopping, basically. So if you call window shopping a trip purpose, then people are doing fulfilling a trip purpose as they walk along. Streets also have a political role, of course. This is actually a pro-Soviet demonstration taking place in Red Square in Moscow, which is quite nice, a bit of a democratic street expression of political opinions in this particular case. So streets are commercial spaces. As we know, they are political spaces, they are social spaces, spaces where you go to meet people. What else? This example from Mexico, I just quite like this picture. It kind of seems to show the kind of free movement walking around. This street seems to be quite pedestrian friendly, even though it hasn't necessarily been designed like as a pedestrian precinct. It seems to have a kind of natural human scale and friendliness to it. This is from La Rochelle in France. Nikos Salangaris showed us some pictures of this kind of thing, showing the relationship between permeability between the pedestrian environment and the wider street public space. Okay. Oh, and then this one example is from Venus Fort in Tokyo, off Tokyo Bay. This is actually a shopping centre, and this is a sort of Italian piazza, like inside a building. So you know, it's like a big box building from the outside. You go in and you go up a lift inside it, and you come out into this nice Italian square. And I think you know, this kind of demonstrates that I suppose these kinds of environments must be work in some way if people go to the effort to build these, even if they go to the effort to build these inside. Incidentally, the sky apparently changes every 20 minutes or so to a nice red sunset and back to blue. And apparently people spend more at dusk. So it's dusk every 20 minutes or something. So great, fascinating place to go. But really, I think it does tell us something, this story about urbanism in a sense, because here we are in this high-tech country. You know, you arrive by some, I don't know if you call it a PRT, you arrive in some kind of modern 21st century vehicle technology, you come to your big box, and once you're inside, you enjoy yourself in a nice historic environment. Okay, so what then, if we're designing for walking, what things might we take into account? And at this point, I'm going to engineering mode, these are the kinds of things, if we see the pedestrian or walking as a mode of transport, then these are some of the things we might take into account. Compared with vehicles, a pedestrian has limited speed and range, a pedestrian is manoeuvrable, and has a tight turning radius, therefore we can force pedestrians into narrow corners and so on. Can negotiate non-continuous surfaces, like stepping stones or even steps and so on. And we know that pedestrians are also sensitive to the weather as well. Now, as I say, this is looking at the pedestrian, I suppose, from a kind of starting off thinking of it as a transport mode. And of course, there's a grand, honourable tradition of doing so. And this picture here just shows some examples of how we could relate pedestrians to other modes of transport, where we can see that the pedestrian has the disadvantages of being unassisted, not power assisted like other vehicular modes. On the other hand, the pedestrians are kind of free range, can go anywhere in the way that public transport can. So there are many ways in which we can analyse different dimensions of the pedestrian as a kind of means of transport. The problem is when we come to the urbanism or the physical spaces that we end up designing. I show this picture partly because I just really like this kind of engineering was seen, and I'm talking to someone who trained originally in engineering, but this kind of thing was seen as very, you know, very good engineering because, you know, look at the beautiful spiralling ramp. You know, it's aesthetic. Was that not good? Is that not nice? But is it what the pedestrian wants? And this kind of design, I think, to me, sums up some of the problems we have or have had in the past when treating the pedestrian as if a person is just a human vehicle, just a small, slow object that moves around, you know, with a certain design speed and crest curvature on the bridge and so on. I have to admit, this example is from Glasgow, and there's a reason why I'm saying that, which I'll come to later. This is from Leeds, so yes, we know pedestrians don't like the elements, so let's put them inside and we have all these nice walkways. This is Leeds University within an institutional context. It's not such a bad place, actually. Mind you, lots of concrete. This example is from Christopher Alexander's book, Nature of Order, showing a particularly depressing environment for a pedestrian. And the point being that someone designed this, you know, this is the apple of someone's eye. You know, someone spent evenings probably working late on this kind of thing. you know, this didn't happen by accident. This is my point. You know, this kind of thing didn't happen by accident. This was someone's idea of a good design. Now, I know that you've probably seen all these kinds of pictures before, but the fact that we seem to keep on designing these things means that I feel, you know, it's okay if I show you a few more examples just to keep in mind where it's not enough just to, as it were, engineer a surface for a pedestrian to be walking along. What else? This is in Houston, which I visited about 11 years ago, a department store where when you walk along the street, the building is completely bricked up. So there's no interface between the street and the department store. The only sign that's a department store is, of course, on the roof. You know, wouldn't line up where there's a freeway going past, so people on the road can see the department stores there. To my shame, I didn't have time to remove this image, which I should have done, because this is, I'm afraid, from Austin. I was going to take it out, but having admitted that Glasgow is bad urbanism too, well, there it is. I took this picture. I think there's the sign. I'm not sure if the sign says beware pedestrians or if the sign is, you know, saying pedestrians beware. I don't know. It seems like an environment full of, it seems like an environment designed for vehicles. And okay, you can probably get two prams passing at 20 miles an hour or something along the footway there. But it's not, even having a tree doesn't necessarily mean it's a good pedestrian environment to be in. So apologies, Austin. And this is the example. Is from London, where just I think the pedestrian space is over to the right somewhere. Okay, I think you know, some of the leftover space is where the pedestrians go. Oh yes, and this is also from Glasgow. There you go. You know, urbanity designed by humans for other humans. Yeah. Usually for other humans, especially. Note that this is. This environment is almost diametrically opposite the savannah landscape that I was talking about. Savannah, which has got lots of paths through it, you can see far ahead, you can hide, you know, the prospects and refuge. And here we have the extremities of large open exposed areas, etc., etc. So these environments are not kind for us. Okay, so the message then is, we need to consider the human perceptual and psychological factors that make for a good pedestrian environment. So we can throw in, and these examples are from a European project. This says pedestrian scale, so try and design for the human scale. public space as a living room, somewhere you might want to spend time, not just a waiting room, which is maybe on the left, but somewhere you'd want to stay and occupy an outdoor room. Perception of space as being for pedestrians, this little cartoon kind of shows that on the right. On the left, it seems to be space for cars, on the right, for pedestrians. We're also reminded that we have to take into account the social environment as well as purely the physical environment, and this research by Carrie Rahala on the PROMPT project investigated a lot of this aspect of pedestrians. And there's a PROMPT website somewhere that has all the reports to do with this. So we have to take into account in his slide here, not just the body and the physical environment, but the mind and the social environment as well. And this is a way we can try and think about covering all the angles. Also, I'd suggest don't forget where the pedestrian street is in relation to other spaces and locations. Okay, providing pedestrian streets isn't just a matter of providing a good infrastructure, like nice paving slabs, nice surfaces, a nice sort of microclimate. You have to consider, well, how does this space relate to other spaces in the city? And also, how does it relate to other transport modes? Because, pedestrian can't go everywhere. So you have to see how it relates to transit in particular, so that you can extend the reach of the pedestrian that way. Also in terms of how the pedestrian is accessible to different land uses. Again, the PROMPT project suggests things like localization of facilities, which, again, this is a land use thing, so it's not just about transport. What else? Also, in terms of the social spatial structure, identity of place, cognitive maps and so on. And this is to do with things like the social logic of space. Many of you may know Bill Hillier and Julian Hansen's book with that name. Also, these particular examples are from Spaces and the Machine, and this it does say Hillier 1996 down here, but this slide is slightly cut off. In fact, maybe you didn't see any of the things I was showing earlier. it all said Rahala 2007. They're all on here. What Bill Hillier and colleagues Julian Hansen and so on remind us is very much to do with how the use of space, the use of pedestrian space in particular, is influenced by where that space is in the network. And how people perceive space and move around in space and so on. So it's not just a matter of getting the physical conditions right for an individual pedestrian space. You could create a really nice pedestrian space, but if it's in the wrong place, then how can people make use of that? Then it may not fill up with people. If it doesn't fill up with people, then it won't feel like these wonderful spaces that we see, usually somewhere else, in some other city or country, which are full of people, like an artist's impression, drinking coffees and sitting outside in the pavements and so on. So you have to think where that pedestrian street should be in the network, as it were. So basically, coming towards the end, we can assemble some of these ideas in a framework, which goes off to infinity down here, of course. This is the kind of a very basic approach here, where we deal with pedestrians as if we're just dealing with pedestrians, a moving object, and the physical design of the infrastructure. So what I'm suggesting we try and also keep in mind is to try and keep in mind the pedestrian as a whole human, it says there, yes. This is also from Christopher Alexander's book, which shows people using spaces in informal ways, in social ways, in ways that go beyond simply someone walking from A to B, as it were, a transport mode. And then the other dimension we add in, location and configuration, where the pedestrian is. Even if the pedestrian is only a moving object, how does that moving object relate to the other moving objects that we call transport modes? Then to complete the square, how do we relate the pedestrian in the full psychological and social awareness sense to the wider configuration of space, cognitive maps of where places are and how people fit into that. So, to sum up a few brief messages, pedestrian then is more than a mode, it's more than just a mode of transport. Pedestrian streets must be functional for pedestrians in physical terms, so that's like a basic requirement. So we saw a great slide yesterday of a pedestrian sidewalk just stopping in the middle of nowhere. Okay, so having the pedestrian sidewalk continuous, having the physical provision for the pedestrian is great, it's a good start, but you know, hopefully we can try and go beyond that, try and address the whole human, as it says there, with aesthetic factors or social factors. And finally, the last bit says the pedestrian street should connect well with other modes, land uses and the social fabric of cities. And the second slide here then, just to kind of round up, is I also think that design becomes a kind of political activity. I alluded to this morning as well. But basically what we're doing is we're allocating parts of the surface of the earth to different users. You know, this is public space. It may well be scarce urban land. And we as planners and designers and engineers are allocating that space to different people. So it's not just a professional or technical activity, but we're actually doing something that relates to people and politics in the widest sense of the word. And the final point, solutions that we've looked at seem to suggest an interdisciplinary approach. In other words, it's not just a matter of transport planners or infrastructure designers, but we also need to take into account urban design and also urban planning, and indeed the occasional anthropologist or social scientist and so on. And I think the CNU is very good at bringing professions together and sort of working through and wrestling with all these issues. So it would be nice to think that the CNU could sort of spearhead an interdisciplinary approach to really solving these pedestrian problems. So that's all I shall say. There's some further reading there, which maybe will appear in a slide somewhere in someday. Anyway, thank you very much.
So, thank you, Stephen. And just to clarify, I was looking at the computer on the monitor. All the references are on the bottom of the slide. The AV crew couldn't get that last inch to show up, but we're giving all these presentations to Heather Smith, and she'll have everything posted up on the web, so if you want to cross-reference any of this. We also are switching our apples and oranges around up here. So as moderator, I'm going to say we'll take any questions for Stephen now rather than saving them all for the end. Since I'm the last speaker, if I don't moderate right, it'll just cut into my own time, right? So with that, if anybody has one or two questions, we'll go ahead and take those now. Well, if not, Norm, pressure's on.
No, they're
we do have, I see, yeah. Do we see hands? Where? Okay, yes, very good.
Fascinated by the topic about where humans feel comfortable, have the drive to go in, as you seem to intimate. Have you done, or has there been any correlation between those drive forces of where humans will walk to congregate in terms of sort of a metric for the performance of how well it is operating for a pedestrian experientially from a psychocognitive sort of way? So is there, you know, I understand the drive force, but is there kind of like a metric that we could use to help us inform our designing to make sure we're incorporating?
Well, I believe that some of the space syntax people have done these things, and also some other others in the UK have developed things like walkability indices and some metrics that do relate to that. And I think they've done quite a lot of work on the empirical side, actually observing people, for example, observing how people use different kinds of spaces within, for example, a housing estate, and how the shape of the space it will affect where people end up congregating, or and so on. So there is some work there. There is also research out there on, I suppose, sensory urbanism, and things relating to how people perceive space and through the senses and various things like this. So, I mean, I think pedestrians is one of these cross-cutting issues that basically you're starting to deal with human things. So there's probably a whole raft of studies out there, that, especially in the social sciences, that are an extension of people's study of human behaviour, basically, that extends to human behaviour in streets. And maybe some of the rest of us are coming from the other point of view of, like, design of streets and then sort of moving into the human behaviour aspect, just starting to touch on it. So I think there's a lot of diverse stuff out there, but the stuff I'm most familiar with would be some of the space syntax people who have developed a lot of metrics.
So, and with that, I'll take one other question. It was coming somewhere from the back corner.
My question was, you very carefully think of where the wants are going to go, and within 6 weeks you'll see people have made their own apps, which are in a different location than where you carefully planned the walkway to be. Are there any really, is the way that people use space related to where they're going, or just the way we think about moving through space?
Well, I suppose one would start by thinking of ourselves. I mean, we move because we're trying to get somewhere, and, you know, both of these things. I mean, I think from a kind of transport planning point of view, we would say that it might depend on journey purpose. If you're trying to go from A to B, you might be more inclined to walk in a direct straight line by the quickest route, even if it means cutting across a muddy path, muddy area or something. If you're trying to get to your tube station or something to go to work, you know, you might go in a straight line. Whereas if your journey purpose is going for a walk, or, you know, taking exercise, going for a jog, or sightseeing or window shopping or whatever, then you might move in different ways. And, you know, people have observed this from time to time, talking about different swirling movement of pedestrians and track, those kind of things. So I suppose a message coming out of that is that the pedestrian isn't just one kind of person, which I'm sure other people have said many times before. You know, the pedestrian isn't just one kind of person, but it is lots of different people doing lots of different things. So I think that's how I would answer the question.
All right, thank you. Next up, I want to introduce Norman Garrick, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut, and he is also one of the co-chairs of the Transportation Task Force for CNU. And he's going to address pedestrian orientation from a different perspective, something that's a relatively new concept that we're just starting to talk about in CNU, and that's the concept of shared streets.
Okay, thank you. And I was puzzled as to why Stephen was wearing a tie, so I'm glad that he explained that. I don't think I've ever seen you in a tie before. I've actually been interested, it was partly because of Stephen why I got interested in this issue of shared spaces. I went to a conference in 2004 in London, and he had some of the practitioners from the UK there at that conference. And I must say that I was fascinated by the concept, but it was not until I went to the Netherlands last year and to London last year that I started to understand what the concept meant. Because what I thought it was a kind of design, you know, like a roundabout is a design. And I thought that was the case with shared spaces, that it was a type of design. But what I discovered visiting Drakton is that it's not a design. It's really about a design philosophy. And it's really a very subversive idea, because it's saying that the method that we've been using to design streets is inappropriate. And I tend to agree with it. And that's basically what I want to present today. Okay. In shared spaces, the idea is that the design of the space controls behavior. Okay, so we're talking here about user behavior. And the basic idea of shared space is that the space itself controls behavior. So the issue is that signs and signals and lines. You might have some of those, but they play a subordinate role in terms of directing behavior. In the U.S., if people are speeding, the first thing we think of is put up a sign. And if that doesn't work, we get a big trailer that measures your speed, and we think that's going to stop you from speeding. Okay. What this is saying is that we need to consider a different approach. People are speeding because the road is giving the message that they're basically going at the appropriate speed for the design. Okay. Shared space, on the other hand, is saying if we want people to behave in a certain way, we need to design so that they behave in that way. Okay. I would say that, like new urbanism, this concept of shared space is drawing on how we use to design places. Okay. So I think it's very apt for new urbanists to pay attention to this concept, because I think it's akin to the new urbanism. It's drawing on how we designed streets in the past. It's drawing on how people traveled in streets in the past. So for example, in this place in central Amsterdam, this probably has not been advertised as a shared use space, but it essentially is. It's a shared use space, and it's fascinating the things that are sharing this space. The tram, the people, bikes, cars, everything is basically sharing that space. So you see those people crossing at will without a crosswalk. Okay. And so that's the essence of shared use spaces. Okay, this is a street that was built in the 1950s. It's actually the street that I live on in Storrs, Connecticut. It's also a shared use space. The two of my neighbors taking their morning walk. Okay, and it's a very, very comfortable shared use space, actually. The speed on this road is about 22 miles per hour, an average. And everybody in the rest of the town, there are not many sidewalks in Storrs, so people come up here to jog, to walk, to walk their dogs, etc. Okay, but the design is giving the message that this is a residential street, and that you need to share the space with cars, with people, etc. Okay, we're actually having a debate about sidewalks. Not on this road. The neighbors all understand that we don't need sidewalk here, but the connection to the rest of the town. So it's fascinating for me looking at this design. And what's interesting for me in this design is that this is so at variance with actually how we design streets and stores now. You know, the geometric design that is where you have to have a big sign that says 20 miles per hour, and it's a road that is designed to go 60 miles per hour. Okay. And this is another example from Cape Ann. This is near Gloucester. Those of you that saw the movie about the big, what was it? The Perfect Storm, yes. This is Gloucester's the neighbor on Cape Ann. And this street, this is now a tourist street, but a 1700 street that is essentially also a shared use street in New England. Okay. So, Hans Mundermann, the person that conceptualized shared spaces, is basically drew on a place very much like Cape Ann to come up with this idea of shared use spaces. He observed how people behaved in these environments, and he felt that some of those methods of design would be applicable to normal streets. And so that's basically where the idea came from. Okay, and I would argue that in my experience traveling in some of these places, that the best public spaces and streets are the ones where human behavior govern how people behave in those places, that are designed in concert with how people behave. Okay, so as in this case in Amsterdam, I'm not sure if those ladies are watching the signs, but that's a one-way street. And that's also the car pathway. But they're going in the wrong direction. They're walking in the middle of the road. But that's how they behave in Amsterdam because that's what the design promotes in the canal belt in Amsterdam. Okay, this is an example from a presentation by Koop Kerstra, who is one of the engineers that is a huge proponent of shared streets. And this small rural country road, but yet you can see how people are behaving on this road. We have the lines, everything is regulated, etc. So the folks are almost in prison, imprisoned by that line in a nice, neat line. And we should ask ourselves, that car, how fast is that car going on this street? Okay. And the contrast is this example. Not much wider. We always talk about width of it as if it's the ultimate determinant of how people are going to behave. But this street has a very, very different feel, and you would expect that drivers are going to behave differently. So what I would say is that contemporary traffic engineering is based on the idea of regulation and control. And we have put all our stock into regulation and control. Shared space design is arguing that we need to design based on human behavior, so that human behavior will control how people behave, will control how people use the spaces. Okay, and I love how Hans Mundermann and folks that have been getting involved in shared space, how they conceptualize the difference between the conventional design and the shared space design. And they have come up with this concept of a system time. And system time is where the conventional design is applicable. So obviously, in a situation like this, we need lines, we need control, because this is a machine environment. Okay, this is not an environment where you expect people to be sharing the environment with the vehicles. Okay, so that is an applicable place for the use of the Astro Green Book. Okay, this is where the Astro Green Book should be used. In contrast, back to the center of Amsterdam, I don't know how many of you know this particular street. It's a fascinating street because just beyond here, the tracks become one way. Okay. And yet, it's a shared space for trams and for people. Actually, it's not a shared space for bicycles. You have a bike, you have to get off the bike and walk. Okay. And it's one of the most beautiful, I would say, urban spaces in Europe and to me in the world. Okay. And this is the other type of design situation. So we have system design, and this is context design, where you're designing for people. Okay. And what they're arguing is that we need to use different methods of design, depending on whether we are in system time or context time. Okay. And I love, again, this idea of the difference between system time and context time. And in system time, traffic behavior is the governing factor. So the issues that we need to look at are that in system time we have single purpose. It's a facility for a single purpose. It's highly regulated. It's impersonal. It's uniform, and it's predictable. Okay, and we need to consider all of those factors. And this is basically the Astro Green Book or any other conventional design. On the other hand, in context time, the considerations are different, and it brings in some of what Stephen is talking about, where we need to consider the whole person. So in this context, it's about social behavior. Social behavior is what governs. It's multifunctional. So we have some people in a hurry to catch their train. We have some people shopping. We have some people just strolling. We have people in cars, etc. So it's a multifunctional environment. It's culturally defined. It's socially and culturally defined. And people understand how to behave based on the design, It's personal, it's diverse, and it's unpredictable. Another interesting example, this is from Charleston, South Carolina. And again, those people are breaking the law. Just like in Amsterdam, it's not just that Amsterdamers are misbehaving people. These South Carolinians are also misbehaving. But the road, it's clear to them that they can do this. So it's again a culturally defined mode of behavior. And this is probably one of the safest roads in the world. I have not looked at the statistics, but I wouldn't be surprised. Okay, so this is what we have been trying to do. Because we have been trying to impose a wrong system on the context, what we end up with is this overuse of sign. And in England and in the UK, these rails are so hated by urbanists. But the first time I went to this conference in England, the first time I went to an urban conference in England, that's all the spent the time debating is getting rid of the rails. So everything is caged, all these signs to tell you how to behave, and nobody bothers with them. It's very inefficient, it's very messy, it's very ugly. Etc. In contrast to this cartoon-like view of how if you apply the right design approach, then you get very different behavior. And the surprising thing is that it's also a more efficient design system, which is, for a lot of engineers, is very surprising, but it's safer, it's more efficient, and it's also a more human environment. And actually, this is a cartoon, but if you go to the center of London to Seven Dial is near Soho, is in Soho, Flower Place, Covent Garden. Okay, if you go to the center of London, this is actually what you see, a street that was, I think, redesigned quite recently for as a shared space. Okay, so what I'm going to do is to talk briefly about the two places that I visited last year in my quest to try to understand shared space. And one of them was the city of Drachten in the north of the Netherlands. And in particular, I'm going to talk about this one project. There are many others because this city is totally in love with the idea. And they're just rapidly pulling up signs and throwing away signs, and it's just amazing to see what's been going on there over the last 7 years in Drachten. Okay, so this is what that intersection looked like before. It was a normal four-way intersection. It was a very important intersection in the city because all the buses, it's one city in Holland without train service, so all the buses, intercity buses, went through this intersection. Okay, very uninspired urban environment. And basically what they've in describing what they did in Drachten, they described it as deregulating Drachten. So they pulled up all the stop signs, all the stop lights, etc. And just to give you another view of what it looked like before, and this is the new Leiden plain, my Dutch is very good. Okay, it's basically what they refer to it as a square about, where it's based on a roundabout, but it's a shared space design where they minimize the use of lines, signs, etc., and try to control behavior based on the design. And also an important thing was the urban feel of the place. Okay, and this is what it looks like at night, and I believe I've been told that the water level changes with the volume of traffic. So using traffic as a urban art, I guess. Okay, and there is actually, I think you can get this online, there's actually a detailed report of the changes in this intersection. and from a university, an engineering university in the northern Netherlands, and this is what they found. They found less congestion. The issue was that if you have to stop at a sign, you're using up a light, you're using up time. What they found was that the time through the intersection actually decreased in some cases by up to 50%. So the traffic was going much slower, but it was going steady. So there's a steady flow of traffic through the intersection. They found that the vehicles see priority to the bikes and the pedestrians. Okay, and another thing that they found, which is, I didn't think this was worth noting, but the Dutch seem to think so, that the bikes are using signals. And apparently, bikers in the Netherlands don't bother with signals. So this was a change, because everybody has to negotiate using that intersection. So there were all these changes in terms of how people are behaving. They found much fewer traffic accidents. And of course, I think probably the most important is that it's a much higher quality of public space. The engineer and urban designers are pictured in the bottom picture there. Okay. But what I think is fascinating to me is that I went to this city. It has a very high quality of streets and public spaces beginning to emerge, but it's a very uninspiring architecture. It's a very uninspiring place as an urban place. But what is fascinating is that I think that the changes that they've made to the street is now encouraging them to work on the quality of the urban, the urbanity. And one of the things that they've decided to do, there was a canal running through the center of town, like in many Dutch towns. In the 60s, they got rid of the canal because they needed more space for cars. They needed bigger roads. And now part of the change in the Drachten is that they're restoring the canal. Okay. And this shows what they're trying to go back to, the lost canal in Drachten. Okay, the second place I visited, not by design, totally by accident, I had to go to a concert in Earls Court, and I discovered that Kensington High Street was around the corner. So I got to see Kensington High Street. And if somebody didn't tell you that something special was done in Kensington High Street, it seems rather unremarkable. It works so well, it's such an elegant design that unless people point out to the specific things that were done, it's not quite clear how it changed. Okay. So basically, this is what they were striving for. We desired simplicity, quality, and elegance. And actually, that's what I would say was achieved. So going from the fences that were all over London to a different environment. This is Kensington High Street. Looking at all the signs, the lines, etc., how they handled traffic before, and this is Kensington High Street after. Okay. And again, I'm saying the changes are very subtle. It's about material use, it's about placement, etc. One of the interesting, I'll get to that. This is another view of Kensington High Street. And this is some of the changes this is the same view after. And these are some pictures that I took. What are the interesting changes? Do you notice where the bicycle racks are? That's I don't know how you could get away with that in almost any place. Well, even in the UK. But let's get away with that here. Any sense of why you would put bicycle racks in the middle of the road? Well, keep it off the sidewalks. Anything else? That is true, yes. But what are the objections to it? Okay, well, one of the things, aside from all of that, I think they were forced to do it at first, but then they also realized that if the bikes were in the center, then people would have to cross. And it ends up that people use the road as a shared space, And just to illustrate that, look at where that person is crossing. Okay? There. There's actually a crosswalk. Okay? And so if you need a crosswalk, you can use it. But this is a shared space with, I believe, 25, I don't know what the number is, but it's a high number of traffic. It's one of a very important east-west connection in the city of London. Okay. I think, you went to the tour. Okay. What is interesting to me about Kensington High Street is that, firstly, it's a high volume street. Okay. And it doesn't, I think in most people's mind, a shared street does not look like this. Okay. But it's essentially used as a shared street because of how the ideas about design were worked out. Okay. So more people crossing. Okay. I hope that's there. Okay. All right. Okay. This idea of shared street, I think, is slowly coming to be used in the U.S., and I wanted to show Rick Hall's project in Montgomery, Alabama. Unfortunately, we didn't get together, but you can talk to him later and see some of his pictures. I'm sure he has them on his pad. Okay, but a very, very nice project, and this is another place that I've started to adopt the idea of shared streets. This is Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's a more modest scale project. And this is what Winthrop Street looks like now. Okay. Yeah, the idea that I want to leave you with is that basically shared space seems to me to be the ultimate in new urbanist streets and spaces. And I think I'm hoping that we'll start to investigate using this concept in a lot of our designs. And one place that it's been used to great effect is in Poundbury. Okay. And I think and I hope that shared spaces, as it becomes more common, what it's doing is really putting the idea of design back into street design. And eventually, it's going to force us to understand that the conventional Ashton method of design does not really have a place in designing a lot of the streets and places that we need. Okay. So thank you very much.
All right, do we have one question for Norman while we do the switch up here quick?
Yes. Oh, sorry.
Okay, this is Sue Everett from New York. Do you change the culture, especially in the U.S.?
Yes.
Cars being prominent and ignoring and being irritated with pedestrians and bicyclists, do you have to make those infrastructure changes, or can you change the culture some other way?
No, I don't think you have to make those infrastructure. Are you finished?
Oh,
sorry. No, I don't think you have to. I think it's the next step. Okay, I think there are lots of, like, Davis, California has no shared spaces, but they've been able to accommodate bicyclists in a very, very comfortable way in the city. Okay, and they use just conventional design. Okay, but they think about the bikes and the pedestrians. What I would argue is that this next step is about the quality. I mean, Davis is not a particularly beautiful city. Okay. This is about the quality of the urban spaces. So if you're going to that next step of wanting to make higher quality urban places, I think that's where you look at the shared space. Okay. No, they have streets that are designed to accommodate. They have bicycle lanes. They have bicycle paths. They have lots of 40% of people commute by bicycles in Cambridge. Cambridge is growing also, but in Davis. So it's the design, you can use conventional design and achieve some of the same aim. But I would argue that certainly in cities where you have less space, this is certainly an applicable way, but also where you're concerned with the quality of the urban space is where, if you look at the difference in that street in Cambridge, you see the difference in the urban quality. So you get people to use the space, not just as a transportation mode, but also it expands the urban, the public space, the nice public spaces in the city.
Any other questions now, or you want to save them for the end? One more.
I just have a question about, in the European context, a lot of the cities have big pedestrian sectors in the center of town.
Yes.
Avenue, places like that, historic cores are pretty well devoted to pedestrian traffic. Although if you're residents in those areas, you can sort of gain access to hydraulic walls.
Right.
In the Netherlands, are they looking at shared streets as essentially alternatives, doing this with full bore pedestrianization of precincts, or is it something that's
My experience in the Netherlands is that these pedestrian-only, certainly in the bigger cities, these pedestrian-only precincts are not that popular. And in fact, they're not that popular in a lot of places, and probably because of the quality of the design. A lot of these were done in the 70s and 80s. I don't know if Steve wants to... I think the issue in the Netherlands, this is related to the idea of self-explaining places, and that was a concept that came about in the Netherlands to say that the design is really an attack on the design approach that we're using. Okay, so that, I think that's part of it, but it's also that, it's not a continuum with pedestrian only ramp.
Please.
Yes.
So very similar to pedestrian malls in our country, that a lot of them have been reopened up to limited access vehicular travel. We'll take one more.
Just a quick note about Davis. One of the reasons Davis works so well is about 20% of all trips taken by bikes. And I think the difference, I live maybe 75 miles south of Davis, and the city I live and work in is extremely unfriendly to bikes and pedestrians. And the reason is because no one rides and walks. It's very uncommon to see. So the bully feels comfortable being a bully. But in a place like Davis, they probably beat you with your, with your bike pump if you try to go up and down. But there'd be plenty of people there. It's just not.
I agree and I disagree, because I think places that have made changes have also seen an increase in... Cambridge is a good example. 15 years ago, you hardly see anybody riding bikes in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now I think their bike share is almost 5%. So you have to... I think you have to put in the changes in the infrastructure. In a very, very, as Stephen said, you have to be deliberate about making these decisions, and you can change behavior if you have the facilities correct.
And for both of those communities, since they're college towns, the National Bicycle and Walking Study showed the presence of a university is a surefire way that you're going to get higher levels of bicycling and walking as well. But with that, I'm the final presentation of the session, and your final presentation of the day, as far as concurrent sessions go. So I'm Terry Musser out of Boulder, Colorado, with a consulting firm called Charlier Associates. And the topic for our session today was pedestrian-oriented streets. And I'm going to deviate a little bit, but this was planned. I'm not doing it. We agreed to this up front. I'm going to talk a little bit about how can we make all streets more pedestrian-oriented? Because a lot of these shared space kind of concepts, like if you think across the transect, they only really work in certain areas. So I'm going to present some things that our firm has been working on. But first of all, I want to reference this book by Rebecca Solnick, and it's called A History of Walking. Now, I'll tell you, you just had two professors. You didn't get a big history letter lecture. I'm the consultant. I'm not going to do it. I want to explore and tell you about a concept that she brings up in her book, and that is the pace of thoughts. So if we look at our civilization and how we as humans have evolved, and we look at the timeline, we have been nomadic hunters and gatherers for most of the while we have been on this planet, and only a small blip have we actually been an agricultural society. Looking at that in terms of the evolution of human history, the car, which is what everything is designed around now, is a very, very recent phenomenon. And even more recently than that, we are really in our first or possibly only our second generation of children that are growing up thinking this is normal. And there's new phenomenons like soccer moms. We all know soccer moms. Well, 17 full days a year shuttling kids around. When I first saw the slide from the EPA, I was like, no, it can't be, because I have a confession to make. I'm a soccer mom. I drive a minivan, that van. That's one of my two kids I shuttle around for soccer. And I'm not going to spend that much of my life doing such. And when we get ready for soccer, come on, hurry up, get in the van, get your water bottle. Oh, you forgot your ball. I mean it now. One, two, I don't know what they think I'm going to do on three, but it works every time. Maybe we should try that in some of our discussions with traffic engineers. One, two, no. But by the time we get through that whole process, my stress levels are going at 85 miles an hour, and I haven't even gotten the car in gear yet. The other half of my personality, and it's not just because this child is a lot different than the other child, but when we go to soccer practice, same event, same activity, same everything, but we do it by walking, it is completely different. And part of the reason is I live in Prospect Newtown, which is the first new urbanist project in the state of Colorado. It's a DPZ project. And so when we walk to go to soccer practice, the coach is in the neighborhood, half the team's there, other people come from surrounding areas. The things that you experience in the way you live your life, I'm not counting one, two, three. I'm hearing things. I'm smelling things. I'm noticing all the little details that make my neighborhood really unique. And if you've never been to Prospect, it is the one that is really unique, with the purple house next to the orange house and the greenhouse across the street. But when you go through here, it's about you get a chance to meet people. We're walking very short distances. It takes us a lot longer than driving the car, because I can't do it without stopping and talking to someone or having three or four dogs come up to me. So life is very, very different when you experience it at 3.5 miles an hour or less. So as a new urbanist, we know this. If we look at the charter for the Congress for New Urbanism, walking and pedestrian, it's in there all the time. But do we really understand how do we effectively address walking? So this is what I want to talk about today, and basically three things. There's different reasons why people walk and different places where they like to walk. And then I want to bring this back and talk about the transect. And basically the underlying theme is that not all walking is created equal. So for types of walking, we generally think that there are five types. The first one being utilitarian walking, and on my slides, all the locations are cut off the bottom, so you'll have to visit the website to find out where all these pictures are from. This one happens to be Redmond, Washington. But basically, utilitarian walking is, I'm using it to get from point A to point B. A lot of people do it out of necessity. It's usually very direct, short trips. Rambling. This is usually more recreation-oriented. It could be walking the dog, going out for a run with a stroller, jogging. Direct point A to B access isn't as important as the quality environment, because you ramble around and you really appreciate where you are. Strolling and lingering is the next step up, and this is where people want to just wander around, leisurely take their time, usually by retail, see and be seen, which is really the next level of types of walking, which we've lost in our country. If you think about where does boy meet girl, teenage society in America, where does this happen? It's inside of our shopping malls, and most of those shopping malls are decaying and dying off. So even that kind of promenading is disappearing in the U.S. And then finally, there's another very specialized form of walking, which are special events. And so this is very closely related to a place. You don't find special events unless they occur in special places. So when we look at the types of pedestrian environments, when we look at the types of walking, I should say, we've come up with four categories of different types of environments where walking will occur. Because, you know, people are always coming up to me and saying, Terry, you know, how we want to be pedestrian friendly. Like, oh, once we get that designation, all the problems of the world are going to be solved. And basically, it's not black and white. It's shades of gray. So we've developed this as a continuum of pedestrian friendliness where you have different levels of accommodation to fit both the needs of the users and the needs of the place. It's reflective of the place type. So this is something that we call pedestrian science. It's really more the art of pedestrian science because it is more our art form than science. What we do is we'll take a look at what are these place types and what are the types of walking. So utilitarian walking will occur pretty much everywhere. If the environment's nicer, you'll see a little more of it. Rambling, which again is that recreational pursuit, hardly occurs at all in the intolerant areas. And then when you get into the strolling, lingering, promenading, those are really only occurring in what we call pedestrian places, or we'll call them pedestrian districts. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I can. They're not showing up. Okay, so this one's pedestrian place. This is pedestrian supportive. This one, I'll go back. This is pedestrian place or district. It's the highest. When we had the transportation summit in Boulder, somebody said, you know, it has to be more than just a place. It has to be pedestrian seductive. So we're actually working on a regional transportation plan for Flagstaff, and I think they might be going to use that term. This one is pedestrian supportive. Over here is pedestrian tolerant and intolerant. We just got done working on a downtown plan for Scottsdale. And downtown, we can't be tolerant or intolerant. So they're compatible and challenging, but same thing, just by different words. So one of our first an early project where we looked at using this methodology was when we did the TMP update for Redmond, Washington. And we're multimodal transportation planners, so, you know, we're looking at cars, vehicular network connectivity, transit, pedestrian, bike, all the modes rolled into one. And so basically this yellow area is downtown Redmond, and this is Overlake. Microsoft is headquartered here. So those are areas that the community really wanted to be pedestrian supportive. And where the little pedestrian icons are, those are the embedded places where we really want to have the high quality. The orange lines are multimodal corridors because they wanted to have a little bit better stuff in other places, and then the green area represents pedestrian tolerant. So what we were able to do is go through and work with them also as part of a comp plan update to define various parts of the built environment and what it is that they would need to do to achieve this vision for the type of environment that they want to have. Since then, they've actually gone out and done a physical inventory. And I was talking to the planner a few weeks ago, and he's like, Terry, we're so amazed. The intern came back, and it all lines up with the methodology. So it worked for them. But then a couple years ago, we had, it just doesn't always work in all places. So we had this kind of aha, let's overlay it with the transect and see what happens. And we found some pretty good, you know, as soon as you categorize something, everything breaks the rules. But for the most part, there's a pretty good correlation here. So I'm going to just walk you through probably very quickly because we are running over on time, what each of these categories are and what they will look like in different areas of the transect. And as I begin to start to do this, if you want to keep in mind, the one way this methodology is really good, it's like no matter where you are in terms of place, you know you can always make yourself better, but you don't always know how to get it to get to the next step. And if you pull out like the pedestrian plan for your region or your state, it says all these different things that you can do that are just mind-boggling, and nobody has any idea of, well, which piece is supposed to apply where, and is it going to give the effect that we want, and all these other questions come up. So starting at the bottom with pedestrian intolerant, these are the characteristics. And since I'm summarizing, I'll just cut to the chase. These are not places where we want to be when we're out walking around on foot. They're just not made for the pedestrian. You know, they can be in the T1, the preserves. This is actually on West Maui, where really steep slopes, thick vegetation. I actually had a hike through this jungle. It's not pedestrian friendly in any shape or form, but it's a wilderness area, so it's acceptable to be pedestrian intolerant. Likewise, when you get in the T2, which is the rural, it's acceptable to have pedestrian-tolerant facilities. You don't have density. Your travel distances are way beyond walking. To put a sidewalk along a rural road, nobody's going to do that. So pedestrian-tolerant or intolerant is okay here. The problem is it's very prevalent across all the other transect zones. We see it everywhere. Some places it makes more sense. This is actually in the city of Minneapolis, but it's a freeway. So you don't want to have the pedestrians walking along it. So again, it's okay to be pedestrian intolerant. But that's not always the case. There are other places where people want to walk and there aren't facilities provided. And again, this can be, it's not just the T3 suburban kind of parts of our nation. This is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Very, very urban neighborhood. And there's no sidewalks, or if there were sidewalks at one point in time, they're in such state of disrepair that they no longer function. So usually it's a lack of facilities, but people can recognize that they have a problem and try to fix it and still be pedestrian intolerant. So this is on Hawaii Island, where they were really, really trying to do something for pedestrians. And yeah, somebody put some thought into this design to try and improve it for pedestrians, but we would still call this a pretty intolerant or hostile environment. So if we move up to the next category, which is pedestrian tolerant, this is basically represents a very minimal level of walking. So it's like, oh yeah, we provided for the pedestrians, we did minimum ADA or minimum ASHTO, nothing else. But again, to summarize, I just really don't feel like I belong here. And this is the great thing about this methodology. You don't have to crunch a lot of numbers and know that, oh, a 7.3 means this or an 8.9 is this. People just know pedestrian intolerant, it intuitively doesn't feel right, so they understand it. We see an awful lot of this in suburbia. There will be, it's basically auto-dominated. There is a sidewalk. It's immediately at back of curb. Every driveway cut, it goes up and down. There's no trees, no shade, no amenities. This could be anywhere in the country. Since the name's not up there, we'll let it go. But even in the more urban zones, you can still have intolerant conditions where, you know, you do have a walkway and you have a fairly narrow street. This is actually downtown Nashville, but they have what we call the blank wall syndrome. So it's not really pedestrian supportive, and it's just, yeah, if I have to be there, I will, but it's not ideal. Back to Redmond, Washington, typically this is what you'll, you know, not typical in Redmond, but as a typical example in the U.S., when you're in an intolerant environment, the sidewalk is right at the back of the curb, and the traffic will be high speed, high volume, and there's real no coordination, as this shows with like utilities, and when decisions are made, the pedestrians always get the leftover space. And then this one is on Kapalua on West Maui, which is a high-end resort that wants to have a lot of walking, but it's the inadequate width of the facilities means that it's just pedestrian tolerance. So we've been working with them on how do we get to pedestrian supportive for this resort where they have a lot of demand for pedestrian travel. So pedestrian supportive, this is probably the category that I would like to see pedestrian supportive everywhere. If we have a little bit of tolerant hanging out over here and we've got those few great places over here, let's make the rest of the world pedestrian supportive, and that would be great. The measuring stick that we kind of intuitively use that people get is, you know, I could let go of her hand and she could run off ahead or cross the street by herself. She's going to be okay because it's designed well enough that if it works for people who are 8 or age 80, then it's going to work and it's going to benefit the rest of the population. So this is Austin. This is the view out of my hotel room. It's the T1. It's the preserved open space. A lot of communities have greenways that thread through their community. Very classic example of pedestrian supportive, accommodating that rambling type of walking. It can also happen in rural areas. This is actually the Cinque Terre, where you can walk between communities. Here in the U.S., it's not nearly as prevalent unless, like, you're hiking the Pacific Crest Trail or somewhere out in my state of Colorado. Most of where you see pedestrian supportive, naturally, is within communities. And I'll talk about this in a little bit detail in a minute. But when you're on a commercial street, what you want to think about in terms of design to reach pedestrian supportive is very different than what you would do for a pedestrian street. So I'll get into that in a little more detail, because this is the one type of environment that you would want to create in as many places as possible. And then pedestrian places, these are those few special places where you want to take people. You want to see and be seen, where the people come in from out of town. And they have to be limited in their scope. The market, the design of it, the walking distance, they won't go on forever. So they're those very special places. And they'll occur usually in, like, the T4 plus and in the T5 and the T6. So it could be where your street side retail is located. Or in the case of Waikiki, you've got, like, the beautiful natural feature of the ocean nearby. It can also be the shared space concepts that Norman and Stephen were talking about. This one's in Brighton, England. And it can be the pedestrian malls, like this is our one in Boulder. So and if you've noticed on all of my slides, the one thing that's happened as we go through the series, you go from no people to one person to maybe three or four people, and then by the time you get to place, it looks like this, and you've got street performers, and there's just a lot of synergy going on. So with that, when we overlaid it with the transect, just to show you some of the real value of using this kind of a process of, we're not just going to provide a pedestrian facility, but we're going to provide one that creates the type of place that we want, and we're going to do it in a way that's sensitive to the geographic type of place where we're located. This was a plan that we did for the East Eva Plain, which is going to be Second City Honolulu. I know the colors are wrong. We're supposed to be using blues, but this is a few years old, so we are still using the shades of reds and oranges. But what we could do once we combine the pedestrian science with the transect is we could actually get into very specific street types, or I hate to say functional classification, but our street types, and we could correlate that with the transect zones and then really get into the detail of how do you handle the pedestrian environment. This is Scottsdale downtown, one of the current projects I'm working on, where it's a huge downtown. And I asked them if they use the transect or new urbanism, and they said, no. We have type 1 and type 2 development. Type 1 is T4. Type 2 is T5, just by different names. So what they have there is they call it the hole in the donut, where they want one story. Have you ever been to Scottsdale, like the most western town? So it's all one-story retail, and that's the part that they really want to preserve for local character. So the other thing they have downtown are a lot of different districts, and each one wants to maintain their own identity. So one, they all want to be pedestrian friendly, blanket out pedestrian friendly. They want to have their own identity, but they don't have, and they have got tons of design guidelines that they're starting to implement, but it's not giving them their results. So what we sat down with staff and did, and then we've also worked through an extensive public process, is looking at nodes and corridors, and where those nodes are, you can develop to pedestrian place standards. And then in some of these highly supportive blue corridors, you go to a different standard, which is a highly supportive pedestrian standard. And we went through five or six different plans that they had and pulled out, because this is a policy plan only, so we pulled out all the policy language. And we could look at, because we know these are the physical design characteristics that you want to have to achieve this vision, we could very quickly go through and say, okay, well, you know, you've got these policies, but you need to consider adding this and this to the downtown plan update. So it was a way to have parts of the downtown be even more pedestrian friendly than others, and yet they could customize it throughout each of their districts. So really quick, some lessons learned as we've been traveling at 3.5 miles an hour, walking around, figuring out how in the world you address pedestrians. The main thing to remember is that great streets relate to their places. And even the not so great streets, they relate to their places. So what happens here is directly influencing and influenced by what's happening here. Likewise, what happens in the street corridor and the adjacent land use, they're integral. You can't design and you can't think about them separately. Same thing in Portland. The two relate to each other. So when you look at what happens here in the roadway corridor and what happens at the adjacent land use, they relate to each other. And so this area in the middle, that's what the pedestrian realm is. Now, these are the terms that our office had been using prior to when the ITEC and U manual came out. So they use slightly different terms of, oh, they're cut off the bottom. Okay, our terms when we're using these from now on. But basically, this is called the travelway. This would be called the roadside, even though it's for pedestrians. And then over here is the context. But when you think about the pedestrian space, you need to break it into those three components. So just as one quick example, going back to the first floor land use, when you're in residential, you want a grassy planting strip separating sidewalk from street. When you're in commercial, you don't. I can't tell you how many communities we go in and their codes require a landscape buffer here, and even for commercial uses, oh, it's kind of cut off, but like the landscaping in front of the buildings, they're requiring that in front of commercial buildings, and they wonder why they're not getting the synergy to really create these really nice pedestrian spaces. So this is how, when you start talking about the matrices, you really have to go several levels deep, because in this case, the first floor land use really comes into play. Now, the SMART code and some of the other form-based codes really do start to understand this, because if you look at the private frontage types, there's a distinct difference here from the residential frontages to the commercial. And you can see, like, the tree lawn stops and then the trees go into tree wells. When you look at public frontages and even the thoroughfare assemblies that are in SMART code 9.0, for example, it's not as clear. They have one, quote, commercial street, and it can go in just the zones T5 and T6. Well, we work in a lot of smaller towns that, yeah, T5 scares them. There's no way they're even going to get close to T6, but they still have the commercial component that they need to deal with. So if you look at what this means in terms of sidewalk facility width, for highways and roads, it's optional if you want to build a path. The sidewalks for the streets, as close as I can tell, it depends on right-of-way, but those widths vary quite a bit. For the most part, 6 foot, maybe up to 13, and then the boulevard jumps back down. In contrast, if you look at what the recommendations are in the ITE manual, where they separate out that first floor land use, you pretty consistently see a minimum 6 foot sidewalks in residential areas, maybe 8 foot if you have like higher levels of dwelling units per acre. And then your commercial will go from 12 feet anywhere to 20 feet plus. So they've got the ranges in there. But what we like to do when we overlay the pedestrian science methodology with this further is you can look at the through traveled way, and because of what you want to create, if you make it narrower like this, this will be a pedestrian supported. If you really want to create a pedestrian place, you need to make it wide enough to accommodate the kinds of use that you want. So if you want outdoor cafes and you want to encourage bicyclists to come downtown and have a place for bicycle parking and any number of, you know, water fountains or whatever it is, you need to provide enough space to have that level of urban activity happen. Then back to the residential side, just one quick like lesson learned that we work with people all the time. This separation distance between curb and street, when you're on a nice, slow street, like this is one in my neighborhood, you can get by with a pretty narrow planting strip. As the speeds go up, number of lanes go up, roads, stress, all that from the noise goes up, all the road activity, you want to increase that separation distance. In this instance, it wasn't just enough to do it with just grass. It was actually a split rail fence and landscaping just because the traffic was so fast that perceived separation wasn't enough. So what we can do by using this methodology is typically the roadway does not change, but the context can. So if you look at, this is actually a collector roadway on an upcountry Maui project we were working on, you can see how, this is T2, this is rural, this is T3, and this is T4. But even though this is T4, this is upcountry Maui. This is where the cowboys and the paniolos are. They don't want anything really dense. But you can see how the roadway design stays the same. What happens on the edge, how it relates to its place, changes. And then because this design changes, the speed of the vehicles as they move through the community will also change. So just really quick to wrap up, because we are over already, aren't we? We are. Took questions in the middle. I'm going to stop. I kind of had this as a temporary stopping point if we did go over. But basically, I'll take a few questions, and I apologize that we did run over. And with that, just remember that the pedestrian science is very indicative of place, and it's not necessarily an assessment of the conditions you have on the ground, but it's a really, really powerful visioning tool that the public relates to for the kind of places that you want to create. So with that, I guess we'll be up here and we'll take any other questions. Otherwise, you're free to go, because I just noticed we ran out of time.